Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings, interviews Dr. Connie Stapleton, highlighted speaker from Obesity Medicine 2020 Virtual, about understanding food addiction. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Many foods taste good. We often crave certain foods, but foods can be addicting. Many of my patients will say they're addicted to foods, though they're often reluctant to mention food addiction out of fear they'll be judged for it. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings. I'm Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education at the Obesity Medicine Association. And I have today with us Dr. Connie Stapleton. She is a licensed psychologist in the state of Georgia. She received her PhD from Texas A&M while raising three children. She works with clients on multiple areas of addiction. Her practice does focus on patients seeking a healthier weight, including psychological evaluations for patients preparing for weight loss surgery. She participated in the OMA virtual conference in May 2020. Her presentation was titled Understanding Food Addiction. So today we're going to explore this topic with Dr. Stapleton. Welcome, Dr. Stapleton.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, your presentation was at the OMA was on food addiction. There are differing opinions as to whether or not someone can be addicted to food. Why do you say that food is addicting, and what is your response to the naysayers?
Well, the response to the naysayers is, I believe it's only a matter of time before the American Medical Association gives their stamp of approval to food addiction being a disease, just like it took a minute for them to say that obesity was a disease. So I really think it's a matter of time. I think there's enough research that indicates that food can be as addictive in terms of brain response as many, many drugs of abuse have been shown to be.
So yes, it definitely took more than a minute for the AMA to adopt obesity as a disease, but we're very happy that they did. So explain a little bit more about those brain pathways that you think are involved in food addiction.
Well, first of all, I think it's more than just brain pathways. There are some people in the world of food addiction that really are say that this is a clearly a brain addiction, like Dr. Vera Tarman, who I have great respect for. But she's all about the fact that this is a neurotransmitter disease and that the core, the old brain, the neurotransmitters are very strongly affected by certain foods, the dopamine, the serotonin, endorphins, the natural endorphins. So she really believes that it's all about a brain issue. I, on the other hand, am more along the lines of doctors like Dr. Gabor Mate or Dr. Pat Carnes, Dr. John Friel, who think it's really more about a psychophysiological process, that there are often underlying psychological issues. And addiction is a continuum. You know, there's a continuum of behaviors that eventually fall into the addiction category. But I believe that there can be a psychological addiction that can be just as powerful as a biological addiction in terms of food. And many patients will very quickly identify themselves as a food addict. They may be talking about emotional eating, but to an extreme where they absolutely believe they have got to have whatever they get from food, whether it's soothing or comfort or instant reward.
You know, similar to smoking addiction, that you have a physical addiction to nicotine, but there's certain behavioral components and psychological components to that as well. So would you see parallels to that in food addiction?
Absolutely parallels with that. And even alcohol. You know, I think you can have a psychological dependency on alcohol without being to the far stage of having a physiological addiction, where if you quit alcohol, not everybody has to go through tremendous withdrawal symptoms. And, you know, I think that you can have an absolute psychological addiction to alcohol or pain medication without being completely physiologically addicted to it.
So do all patients with obesity have food addiction, or is it just certain patients? Are you either addicted or not addicted, or is there a spectrum of food addiction?
In my mind, and a lot of professionals' minds, there's a spectrum, and absolutely not all people who have the disease of obesity are food addicts. Absolutely not. In fact, you know, the Yale Food Addiction Scale, you know, shows that it's a fairly small percentage of people who have who have the disease of obesity who are also food addicts. I believe more people with the disease of obesity would identify themselves as being food addicts without taking a formal scale.
So how is it that you assess for food addiction?
Well, in my pre-surgical evaluations, primarily I listen. I listen for what people say about food and how they use food. And I will eventually ask, you know, have you thought about food as being an addiction for you? And some of them be adamant, absolutely I have. And others are like, no, I haven't. But I believe ethically I have a responsibility, especially for patients who are going to have bariatric surgery, to introduce the idea to them. And I tell them, if you go into surgery with the disease of obesity and the disease of addiction, they're treating the disease of obesity in that operating room. And you're going to come out with an addiction that's alive and well and seeking some reward. So I follow up with every single person that I do a bariatric evaluation for with an email with information about food addiction and a lot of resources.
So we see some patients develop other compensatory mechanisms after bariatric surgery. In particular, they may increase their alcohol consumption or engage in some other type of addictive behavior. Are people with food addictions at higher risk for developing these newer addictions after bariatric surgery?
Without having hard research numbers to validate what I'm going to say absolutely they do.
So what you're saying is, in your experience, you see that pattern, although there's no hard evidence to prove that in the literature.
Correct.
Okay. So how do you manage those patients? How do you prepare them for surgery, or how do you manage them after surgery differently from somebody that doesn't have a food addiction?
I absolutely tell them this is invaluable information because you have got to treat both simultaneously. And so what I'll do is I will give them resources like a couple of books, Vera Tarman's book called Food Junkies. I wrote a book called Weight Loss Surgery Does Not Treat Food Addiction. I refer them to OA meetings. There's a number of online meetings that people can attend. There's one specifically for bariatric patients who also suffer from addictions. So I refer them to those places, and then I will continue to see them in individual therapy as well.
Okay, good. And so forewarned is forearmed as well, so that people may not even have an understanding or an insight to this. Is that true? Do you find a lot of patients don't recognize that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a couple of years after that honeymoon period following surgery, they're going, what is the deal? You know, why am I returning to these behaviors, these old behaviors? And so sometimes there's a recognition of an addiction issue a couple of years after the surgery.
Okay. One of the things that have been of concern is that children are increasingly exposed to sweet and salty foods at an early age. Does early exposure to these types of foods increase the likelihood of food addiction?
Maybe, maybe not. In some cases, I would say yes, and in other cases, I would say no. But clearly, it's introducing them to unhealthy eating habits, which, you know, given depending on what goes on in their lives and what coping skills they're introduced to and what they're taught by, you know, the people in their lives, it could lead to an eating addiction, a food addiction. But it's certainly going to lead them to learned behaviors in terms of unhealthy eating. And that's, you know, likely going to lead to health issues with or without an addiction component.
And returning back to the smoking analogy, children that start smoking at an earlier age while their brain is developing are more likely to have stronger nicotine dependencies. Any data to support that with relationship to food in children?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Certainly sounds like an interesting area of research, though. Weight loss is a big challenge, and weight management after weight loss is an even bigger challenge. How do you prepare your patients for the journey to not just reaching, but also maintaining a healthy weight?
Oh my gosh. You know, that is one of the areas that I am absolutely most passionate about, is maintaining the weight loss. And every opportunity I get to present at a support group meeting or any kind of patient meeting, there's a body of research that talks about, you know, there's the behavior modification that we all incorporate into the weight loss processes, but there's an absolute another set of research findings that shows that there's a number of emotional indicators and psychological indices that can predict successful weight maintenance. And a lot of our patients do not have these skills when they come into the weight loss programs, be them medical or surgical. And it's things like a high self-efficacy. It's things like overall psychological stability. It's things like autonomy. I'm going to do this whether or not other people are doing it with me. And so we have a whole group of people who lack a lot of these areas coming into the program, but most programs are talking about the behavioral modifications that are necessary, but we are ignoring this absolutely critical psychological subset of skills that patients need to have. So I really work hard to get this information out to programs and patients, because we're missing the boat. And if people can't stick to the behavior modifications, sometimes there are reasons that are related to their psychological strength and stability and these coping skills and ability to deal with life stress that we need to acknowledge as well.
And we often see patients that are successful for some period of time, but something changes in life, like a COVID pandemic or seeing traumatic events on the television, like what recently has happened in the news, and people become increasingly stressed, and then they don't know how to respond to that, how to cope with that. So they turn to their old standby, which is food. Is that right?
So very true.
So how do you prepare patients so that they can anticipate those challenges, and what can they do about those to try to prevent that from happening again?
Again, I think that as professionals who treat the disease of obesity, we need to forearm, like you said, forewarn our patients that coping skills are lacking. If using food as a coping skill to deal with stress, which is what a lot of our patients do, it's one of the number one reasons people say led to their regain is stress. So we need to help educate them about healthy coping skills, about how to deal with stress in healthier ways than turning to a substance.
One of the benefits of as you're losing weight, you get a lot of positive feedback, right? Get a lot of positive reinforcement. But I tell patients that weight maintenance is more difficult than weight loss, because during weight maintenance, you're not getting any of that positive feedback. You're not getting any reinforcement. I describe it like having a job where everything you do is right is taken for granted and everything you do wrong is harshly criticized, right? That would not be a very good work environment, yet that's how I see patients treat themselves when they're in weight maintenance, right? Every day you get on the scale, and if it's the same weight, well, that's what's expected of you. But if the weight goes up, there's hell to pay. So how do you help patients navigate that and manage that?
To me, that is one of the biggest tragedies. And I talk to patients a lot about the fat shaming. There's a lot of political work being done about fat shaming nationwide, and that's great, great work. The tragedy to me is the shaming that patients do to themselves when they get on the scale, and it's either going, you know, the absolute way that they criticize and berate themselves. And so I talk with patients a lot about the necessity for changing thoughts, for using affirmations, for, you know, stopping the negative self-talk, that automatic negative thinking. So a lot of cognitive behavioral work.
Yeah, I often talk to patients about critiquing versus criticizing. Very often when they get on the scale and they see the weight go up, they're highly critical of themselves, judgmental, a lot of negative self-talk, versus critiquing where you look at what did I do right, what can I do better? To me, that's the path to self-improvement and something I encourage my patients to kind of shift their thinking around, because I've had patients that just throw away the scale because they get so mad at themselves with any change that they don't even want to go there anymore. But I find that shifting their thinking allows them to pull it out of the garbage and be able to use it again.
Use it as a positive tool, just a marker.
Right. And that's all it should be. It shouldn't come with judgment.
I always joke that someday I'm going to invent a scale. So somebody who's really entrepreneurial out there, go do this. Make a scale that comes up and the first thing it says is, you are a great person, regardless of what this number says.
Yes, that would be a great message. So with this whole COVID pandemic that we've experienced, there's been a lot of a shift to going to online. And myself have shifted in my practice to doing a lot more online patient cares for obesity medicine. And you've been doing online counseling for a while now, is that right?
That is correct.
What kind of tips do you have that might help our providers to better utilize online learning, online patient encounters?
Part of it is just becoming comfortable with it yourself, you know, so it does take a little bit of acclimating. But I think, and especially because a lot of the work I do is evaluations, it's a little bit different if you're doing long-term therapy with somebody. If I have a long-term client, I like, you know, those initial sessions to be face-to-face until we know each other fairly well. But for evaluation purposes, I think online is wonderful, especially for people dealing with issues where mobility can be a problem. You know, it's very difficult to get out and into the traffic and make more time or take time off for work. So I would just say, you know, do some talking online with your family members and friends just to get comfortable with the medium. But I absolutely love telemental health. It's just been a great thing for me and for patients. But in my practice too, I require patients to watch a series of videos as part of their pre-op requirements, because I think there's so much more that patients need to know about this process and what's to come that I made a set of videos so that they are familiar with me by the time we meet face-to-face anyway.
Well, that's good and good advice. I, too, find the more I do it, the more comfortable I become with it. Okay. Last question is, what is your favorite bit of advice to healthcare providers who treat patients with obesity?
Remember that they're a whole person, and that for some of them, the disease of obesity is in part, and maybe a large part, a symptom of the problem. We need to look underneath into their lives and see what purposes food is serving them, and maybe what purpose carrying extra weight is serving them. It's a multifaceted issue. And while we all have our specialties, we need to work as an interdisciplinary team. And I don't think there's enough of that happens.
Absolutely. Many patients struggle with, even when they're successful with weight loss, with their new body image that they're not familiar with and the response that they get from people that they may not be used to can take some adjustment.
For real.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much. I really enjoyed our conversation here and like to thank you for participating in our Obesity Summit, the virtual conference that we've held, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Pennings and Stapleton. For more information about Obesity Medicine Podcast and other resources from the clinical leader in obesity medicine, please visit obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Love this episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show hosts and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.